This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President Obama recently announced the establishment of a new base for surveillance drones in the African nation of Niger, along with 100 American troops to build and support the facility. It's yet another sign of how seriously the U.S. is taking the reemergence of al-Qaeda and affiliated groups on the African continent. Recent conflicts there in Mali, Algeria, Nigeria, Somalia, and Niger have shown that despite talk of al-Qaeda being on the run, the organization is still a force to be reckoned with. And so the U.S. is stepping up its efforts to keep track of al-Qaeda and other groups. In addition to the new drone base, it's signing agreements with some countries to allow the presence of U.S. forces and is not ruling out strikes against suspected terrorist hideouts. But some analysts say the U.S. military needs to be careful. Africa is not especially familiar territory for the U.S., with many diverse peoples, tribes, and languages. And like Afghanistan, the terrain is huge and rugged, which makes any U.S. military ventures there complicated, to say the least. Today in The Exchange, Africa, the latest frontier in the fight against al-Qaeda. Let's hear from you. Do you fear al-Qaeda's presence in Africa, as you might have in Afghanistan or Pakistan? What do you think is the appropriate U.S. response, and how do you think this situation will shape U.S. foreign policy? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We had three guests with us to talk about this. With me in studio is Bess Palmisano, founder of an organization called RAIN, which works to improve access to education, jobs, and other resources for nomadic and rural peoples of West Africa. Bess lives in New Hampshire. She just got back from the region recently. And Bess, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College and director of the Center for Civic Engagement there. You can follow him on Twitter at NEC. Prof. And Wayne, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Colonel Robert Cassidy, military professor at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He's served across the Middle East. He'll be deploying to Afghanistan again this spring. He's the author of three books, most recently War, Will, and Warlords, Counterinsurgency in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Colonel Cassidy, really good to have you, too. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, Laura.
Well, and Wayne, I'll turn to you first for the big question. Why Africa, Wayne, and why now?
Well, I think when most Americans think of al-Qaeda in the post-9/11 world, they think of Afghanistan, and they think of our efforts to rid Afghanistan of that particular terrorist threat. And the good news is we have been incredibly successful there. There's very little left of al-Qaeda as we once knew it in Afghanistan. The bad news is that the folks in al-Qaeda have found a way to franchise the operation, in a sense. And that is that we see pockets of different al-Qaeda movements, al-Qaeda-supported movements, popping up all over the world. Africa is an iteration that has become increasingly troubling in recent times as we see different groups, particularly three different groups, take form in Africa across what's called the Sahel region, which is just a transition zone just south of the Sahara Desert, if you think about that in your mind's eye on a map of Africa. Now, why Africa? Why is Africa particularly ripe to this sort of thing? Africa, this particular region or part of Africa, has a large Muslim population. It has an especially large young population. There's tremendous poverty. There's lack of access to education. So this is a set of demographics that is ripe for conversion to particularly extremist forms of Islam. We've seen the most recent iteration sort of bubbling up in Mali, in the sense that you have a group that have carved out a portion of Mali in the north, for the implementation of Sharia law, and they've done it in a particularly brutal way with forced amputations and rapes and things like that that are particularly harmful or targeting towards women. The French have intervened. The French have sent 4,000 troops, something pretty remarkable, and the United States has taken to supporting the French effort, and we'll talk a little bit more about this as we go along in the show, Laura, but certainly the expansion of the role of the United States in the region as one of supporting the French, particularly in Mali, but also in gathering intelligence and using drones to make sure that we have an ability to react to these different groups that are very active. One last quick point. General Carter Ham, the head of Africa Command for the United States, has been sounding the alarm about Africa since he came in 2011. And we have a couple of authors at a conference with him who have said the United States should expect another attack on its soil at some point in the future. That's something that is probably going to happen. And increasingly, the concern is that the source of that attack will come from these types of al-Qaeda groups in Africa. So that's why we ought to be paying closer attention to what's going on in this continent.
As you mentioned, the drones, Wayne, and President Obama said just a week ago that, yep, we're setting up a new base for surveillance drones in Niger. So there's a lot of activity going on. And yet, Colonel Cassidy, as we look at this, you know, there is, as Wayne said, a lot of new attention to this. We're used to thinking of al-Qaeda as, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan. But looking back over the last 15 or 20 years, Colonel Cassidy, terrorist attacks against America did, in many instances, come from Africa, Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania, and Yemen. So it's kind of, there's kind of a new old element to this.
I agree. Yes, Africa is a very dangerous place. It's full of opportunity and risk. And al-Qaeda has managed to plant some roots in those areas that have bad governance or where the people may be more vulnerable to a radical ideology. I would point out, just historically, though, if you want to be truthful about al-Qaeda, the U.S. government and the CIA do sort of have major stock in al-Qaeda, given what we supported against the Soviets in Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989. We thought it would be a good idea to help empower and fund the Pakistani intelligence services, who also funded the most radical strains of Islamist fanatics who metastasized and ended up forming al-Qaeda and then branching out to these areas in Africa and elsewhere.
When you say has major stock, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, Colonel Cassidy.
It's kind of a quip. What I mean is because we decided way back in 1979 that it'd be a neat idea to train, fund, arm the Mujahideen against the Soviets, we also used the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, the Inter-Service Intelligence Directorate, to arm and fund these groups. But they had their own vote on who they armed and funded, and they funded the most radical strains of those groups like Haqqani, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and others, and Osama bin Laden and the groups he was operating with, who later kind of converged and evolved to be al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda central in the tribal areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. But after 9/11, as we've been discussing a little bit so far, they franchised out after they dispersed some after the initial invasion, and they now they've associated themselves with groups in the northern African area, the Sahel, Somalia, and the Arabian Peninsula and Yemen, and et cetera, et cetera.
So you're saying, Colonel Cassidy, in a way, al-Qaeda's reemergence or continued strength, depending on how you look at it, is partly a problem of our own making?
I would say the problem, its origins is partly of our making, not solely of our making. So we were complicit because at the time we had a rather short-sighted view. We thought it would be neat to defeat the Soviets by arming the Mujahideen, but it seems that nobody thought through the long-term consequences. I actually have an acronym for this. I call it strategic attention deficit. And so for the first 11 years, we armed and empowered these groups. For the next 11 years, after the Soviets left, we basically ignored South Asia, outsourced our foreign policy there to Pakistan, who continued to support the most radical groups that eventually emerged in the form of al-Qaeda in 88, and then in 2001, of course, the catastrophic attack on the U.S. homeland. And after 2001, after the invasion, lots of those leaders migrated back to Pakistan, or they franchised out to places like al-Qaeda in Iraq or al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb.
Which is what we're talking about today. As we look at the expansion of al-Qaeda and terrorist groups in Africa, we'd like your questions and comments on this topic. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. 1-800-892-6477. What do you think about this expansion of al-Qaeda and related groups in Africa? Do you think it's as much of a problem, or even perhaps a greater problem, than the expansion in Afghanistan or Pakistan? Also, what do you think is the appropriate U.S. response to these changes that we're seeing in Africa? Our number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Bess Palmashan, I want to bring you into this, too. You've got a different perspective from our other guests in that you were really working on the ground, again, founder of this organization, RAIN, which works to improve access to education and jobs and other resources for people. First of all, just tell us what country or countries were you working in, Bass?
We work in Niger, and we work with primarily Tuareg nomadic people, our Tuareg who have resettled, and some of them live right along the Mali border. So right now we're also dealing with Malian refugees who are coming into Niger.
Yeah, and just to put it on the map, it's in northern Africa, but it's not north-north Africa, like bordering the Mediterranean. It's surrounded by Algeria, Libya, Chad, Nigeria, and Mali. So.
Yes, it's that bulge of West Africa that's sort of facing America. And Niger is almost 85% Sahel and Sahara. Most of the country is Sahara Desert, similar to Mali in that way.
So what did the people you've been working with there, Bess, say about the possible growth of these terrorist groups in their country? What do they think?
Well, in Niger, I speak to both, of course, the people who we work with, but also I keep in touch with the U.S. Embassy there, keeping track of security for myself and our staff.
Sure.
And, you know, from the embassy on down, it's pretty unanimous in Niger that Niger doesn't have homegrown terrorists and hasn't. However, borders are very porous in West Africa, and so Niger now is really threatened by, in addition to Mali and the people and the radicals there from Boko Haram in Nigeria, which really until this last month of war was seen as the greatest threat to Niger.
So people feel like this isn't our making. This is people from the outside causing problems in our country.
Yes.
What did the State Department tell you about the safety or lack thereof for American aid workers like yourself?
Right now, clearly the most dangerous region is the area going toward Mali. The Niger government itself requires all foreigners leaving the cities to have a military escort. They're very concerned, I think, about also international opinion as well as people's safety. So that region right now on the Mali border is definitely the hottest area.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break and start taking your calls, questions, comments. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More in Al-Qaeda in Africa coming up on The Exchange, then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, choosing a new pope. Governor Maggie Hassan will be on The Exchange with Laura Kanoy tomorrow to discuss her proposed budget. Don't miss your chance to ask the governor your questions about her proposals for the next biennium. Follow the live blog of the conversation on NHPR.org or tune in to The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Franklin Pierce University, a leader in adult education, offering a Bachelor of Science in Healthcare Administration. New term begins in March. Information at franklinpierce.edu. And North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget. Online at Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Al-Qaeda in Africa, the expansion of the terrorist organization and related groups in northern and western Africa have raised alarms around the world, especially in the U.S. We're talking about the reasons for this movement and what the appropriate American response might be. And let's get your thoughts on that. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Bess Palmisano, Wayne Lesperance, Colonel Robert Cassidy, let's go to our callers now. And Oliver's waiting in Concord. Hi, Oliver. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
And, first of all, this is obviously a very important issue because the biggest challenge I think we have in Africa, any military thing, is the term mission creep, which I'm sure Colonel Cassidy understands very well. And what I would ask Colonel Kennedy, Colonel Cassidy, as well as the other guests, is what is their view on the mission, the specific mission that the U.S. military and our U.S. foreign policy should have there in the Trans-Sahel area? Because I've obviously I've spent a lot of time in Africa. I was in Somalia right after the Black Hawk Down incident. I spent 2 tours in Afghanistan and 4 tours in Iraq. So I understand mission creep pretty darn well. And that is my question that I posed specifically to Colonel Cassidy.
So lots of personal experience in this, Oliver, as a member of the U.S. military, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Recently retired.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. And how about that, Wayne Lesperance, and then maybe Colonel Cassidy? Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, I think he identifies a real challenge. I mean, one of the points that Beth made was that there is a tremendous amount of diversity. There's a tremendous amount of need throughout this region. And the long-term strategy for dealing with groups like Al-Qaeda isn't the military strategy. The long-term strategy is to sort of do what folks call draining the swamp, beginning to provide enough assistance so that there is food security, so that there are educational opportunities, there are job opportunities, so that folks would, instead of accepting as their only option joining one of these groups, they have other options. So I would argue that the long-term strategy isn't necessarily a military one. It's more of, you know, a development. It's more of supporting NGOs like what Beth has been doing in their work. The short-term military piece, frankly, the United States doesn't have a stomach for any kind of an expanded military role anywhere. I think the president's decision to send 100 soldiers to set up that drone base in Niger is probably what we can expect. So some over-the-horizon, perhaps military strikes, use of U.S. special operations, and supporting the French for as long as they're there. And then the African Union is also going to be bringing more troops in and supporting those troops. So I see the U.S. in much more of a supporting role than a direct combat role that we saw in Afghanistan.
So less worried about mission creep, Wayne?
Well, I mean, there's always that worry, but I don't think that we're going to be seeing the kind of combat engagements that we were engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's a little bit different, it's a little bit less on the radar. And I don't know that the American people are paying a whole lot of attention to what's going on in Africa. And that's, you know, both bad and, I guess, good if you're wanting to focus more on the clandestine operations.
And Colonel Cassidy, Oliver also wanted to hear from you on this, given that you also have military experience. So go ahead.
Hi, Oliver. I'm not really a fan of the term mission creep, but I get what you mean. And I was president when Africa Command stood up in early 2008, so I can pretty much assure you that we don't plan on an expansive role in Africa. But there was some logic that informed having a command that could unify the effort of interagency efforts. Military has a lot of logistical support and so forth. Our role is really going to be twofold. One is to train and equip and assist the indigenous host nation governments to do security better with some moral rectitude and to help in any way we can their governments to govern better so they're not catalysts for unrest and violence and insurgency and otherwise pushing the people into the arms of groups like Boko Haram and so forth. So the solution is lean, discreet, measured. We don't want a big presence. When we were conferring with our African partners as AFRICOM stood up, it was clear that none of those states wanted a huge presence in Africa. But what we can do discreetly behind closed doors or a little bit overtly is to have a lean presence to train, equip, and make those states more capable of integrating their efforts to get to the border problem, the cross-border security incursions, and so forth.
And Colonel Cassidy, just real quickly, mission creep, give us your best definition.
Well, mission creep, what it is supposed to mean is that we get into a situation and our mission unknowingly, inadvertently expands well beyond our resources. The reason why the term is a tad bit anathema to me is because it was used in the context of Somalia and the Weinberg-Apollo Doctrine, which is another show and another discussion. But essentially, in Somalia, the Weinberg-Apollo Doctrine proscribed doing what we had to do to really address the issues we're causing insecurity. So we went in short for a short term with an exit date already identified, and we actually caused more harm than good because we were constrained by our unwillingness to actually solve the problem. And if you look at Somalia today, it's recovering a bit, but it's still in pretty terrible shape. So I guess my mantra would be, well, whatever we do in Africa, we got to try to do less harm than good. And that's got to be the underlying principle.
Well, Oliver, thanks again for the call, and we appreciate the point. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Bess, you know, Wayne mentioned something a minute ago that's just spot on with what you're doing with your organization, RAIN. He said, instead of using, you know, military might, let's focus on food, housing, education, jobs, kind of what you folks are doing in Niger right now.
Yes, yes, and I couldn't agree more. One of the issues, and I think this is true in Mali and Niger, is that even with bigger organizations giving aid, it's really concentrated on cities and high population areas, which leaves out the desert regions where there's been the most unrest. Those regions are hard to get to. It's expensive to get up there. But there are probably, you know, well, these are estimates, a million or two Tuareg up there and other people who are desperate to have education for their children, to have a way to earn some money. And I think that that's spot on, that that's the biggest need in the area.
Did you have conversations with people about that point that both you and Wayne make, that, you know, are young people in Niger and other countries, although Niger is where you worked, are they making that calculation, Bess? You know, I don't want to go this terrorist route, but on the other hand, they're offering me sort of a job, a gun, some money. Are they having that conversation about which way do I go?
Well, you know, this comes up in Niger mostly because there have been some Tuareg rebellions in the north of Niger. And during those times, I mean, I personally am suspicious of the people who led particularly the last rebellion, who included a lot of, you know, black marketeers and criminal elements. And that grew in two ways. It was interesting. They did pull in a number of people based on legitimate complaints that the Tuareg region in Niger is home to Niger's uranium. They're one of the top uranium producers in the world. They provide a good percentage of France's electricity. There's a lot of...
That's right, because France relies heavily on nuclear power.
Yes, yeah. And there's a lot of resentment in the area about France and now China, the countries who are taking that uranium out without benefiting the people in the local area. And so the most recent rebellion was really based on this kind of equitable treatment economically of people. But then once the rebellion started, the military response was against all Tuareg people. And a number of Tuareg men said to me, I had to join the rebellion. It was either leave the country or join the rebellion, because if I stayed here, I would just be shot or arrested.
Wow. So sort of unwittingly drawn into this.
Yes. Yes. It's, pushed into it.
It's really interesting what you say, too. And I wonder what you think, Colonel Cassidy. Follow the money, right? I mean, I was not aware of the uranium deposits in this region and the intense desire for that resource by the French and the Chinese. What do you think, Colonel Cassidy? Economic reasons.
Well, I think there's always explicit and implicit incentives for people to resort to armed violence to try to undermine their government. So I'm not that familiar with the contest over uranium, but what you've got to look at, what are the catalysts for violence? The catalyst may be a very corrupt police force. It may be an overreaction by the government, like Beth just highlighted. When you go in to resolve a problem that requires a screwdriver but use a hammer, then you cause more people to join the rebellion because they have no other choice, or there's a dilemma imposed on them. And in the case of most of the states in the Sahel, there are varying degrees of, you know, bad government. That was also highlighted in parts of the world like this. Sometimes government and governance are not necessarily synonymous.
Well, again, thanks for that call, Oliver. And the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we look at the expansion of Al-Qaeda and related groups in northern and western Africa. We want your questions or comments. Are you concerned about this expansion in Africa as much as you might have been in Afghanistan or Pakistan? How do you think increased terrorist activity in Africa will shape U.S. foreign policy, especially since we have a new Secretary of State? And what do you think the right U.S. response to these threats should be? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's a Facebook comment from Patrice in Portsmouth, who says, one of the positive aspects of the events in Mali, a mostly Islamic country, is the demonstration to the world of the opposition of the radicalism represented by these terrorists. This demonstrates to the world that the majority of Muslims reject this atrocity as being part of Islam. Patrice says, my family is Malian and lives mostly in Bamako. And boy, Patrice, it's good to hear from you. Thank you very much. What do you think about her comment, Wayne?
Oh, I think it's an important one. And I think you know, one of the things that we're learning with the French successes in places like Timbuktu and others is that there really was a miscalculation on the part of the fundamentalists that were there in how they have tried to impose Sharia law. The brutality that we've seen, even they are recognizing, was too much and too fast. There's a really interesting set of documents that were recovered by the Associated Press after Timbuktu was liberated from one of the leaders there, a fellow named Abdelmalek Droukdoul, who is the head of Al-Qaeda in North Africa. And in it, he wrote this confidential letter. He wrote that the imposition of Sharia law was too quick and too brutal, and that we are alienating the people that we need to support our presence in the region. That's pretty stunning in a lot of ways, that sort of self-awareness, and the fact that they are being rejected by the local Muslim population. So I think that Patrice makes an incredibly important point, and that there is not, at the very least, a willingness by the folks in Mali to try to resist, to try to reestablish control. The fact that they needed the French help, you know, sort of tells you how big the problem was. But it is a rejection, I would say, of that radical brand of Islam.
What do you think, Bess, given your conversations with people there?
Yeah, I totally agree. I've talked to people coming out of Mali as well as people in Niger. You know, Mali and Niger are both mostly Sunni Sufi Muslims who believe in meditation and basically that all meditation is prayer. Niger is a very, you know, secular country. You know, this is slowly being eroded by more Islamist influences coming in, but that's still the basis of the culture, and particularly among the Tuareg, who have always valued their own culture in addition to being Muslim, and the place of women in Tuareg society is very respected and quite strong for that kind of culture. And so this has been very offensive to them, and people have a very strong negative reaction. They see this as infringing upon their cultures and their lives and their religion.
Okay, so here's the tough question, Bess, for you and our other guests. So if people in Niger, where your expertise is, do feel infringed upon, this doesn't go with their what sounds like peace-loving ways, who do they want to help them reject this influence, flush it out of their country, if at all, or do they think they can flush it out on their own? I know that's a tough question for you. You're not a political scientist, but I'm interested in what you think.
I think that, you know, in Niger has a strong isolationist tendency and always has. And I, you know, talking to people, they say, you know, we see what's happening in the countries around us and we don't want it here. And I think they want help keeping other people out of their country and controlling, you know, influences that come in. There's a new government in Niger, just 2 years old, that has much more the influence of the interests of the people at its heart. That's really trying. I would say, you know, a dangerous thing is that right now there's a lot of resentment against the French in West Africa, who are viewed as coming in now to have a second sort of economic colonialism, now that the value of the region's resources are growing. You know, there's petroleum, other things in addition to uranium.
Yeah.
And so it's so being allied with the French is also problematic, I think.
Interesting. And given that China is interested in getting more uranium, that bids up the price and makes France anxious about that. And yet Niger did sign a recent agreement with the U.S. To let the U.S. set up a surveillance drone base so it could keep an eye on these groups. I'd love your thoughts too, Colonel Cassidy, on sort of how peoples of this region who don't want to be infiltrated, if we could put it that way, by terrorist organizations, who they want to help them out of this. It's very tricky.
Well, I'm generalizing, but in most cases, the solution would be local. I would see the role of the government as helping secure the borders from incursions, from outside influence. But internally, I would suspect that the best solution is a local solution. What I mean by that is empower and train the people to secure themselves locally by having a decent police force that represents the face of the government without alienating the people.
What about go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Colonel Cassidy. Sorry.
I wanted to dovetail on Wayne's comment about the overreach in Mali. I would just say generally across that region and in South Asia and in Iraq, we have witnessed the same phenomenon. That is, These groups, the fringe groups, they embrace such a fanatical and zealous creed. They impose Sharia beyond the pale, and they can't reconcile that with the pragmatic need to sustain the support of the people. So what they do is they alienate the people, and we saw that with the Taliban regime in Afghanistan from 96 to 2001. Essentially, the people don't want the Taliban back. We saw that in Iraq in the middle of the last decade with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, went way beyond killing and beheading people, caused a pushback, a throwback from the indigenous Sunni population, and we saw it most recently in Mali. So this is one of their vulnerabilities, where they can overreach, and the information, the perception effects are most harmful to their efforts.
If I could ask you, Wayne, a little bit more about this drone. Again, President Obama just announced this a week ago. Niger says, yes, the U.S., you can set up a surveillance drone base. What are, Wayne, in your opinion, some of the benefits and drawbacks of the U.S. stepping up its drone activity in Africa?
Well, primarily, one of the big pieces is that it's going to allow us to have, you know, much better sense of what's going on the ground. The intelligence capacity, the video photography that comes from, you know, drones flying overhead. Potentially, although I don't think this is necessarily the focus at this point, there's also the potential for strikes using drones. And then this facility, you know, becomes, you know, this sort of clearinghouse of intelligence gathering that we could provide to the French, we could provide to local governments, you know, in terms of what's going on. So, you know, what was interesting was the status of forces agreement. Whenever the United States is going to set up an outpost or a base or something in a country, we set up a status of forces agreement, which just governs, you know, the relationship between the Americans on the ground there and the government. And the folks in Niger were very eager, you know, apparently to allow this to happen. And so they gave us, you know, everything we wanted in that agreement. So that sort of speaks to their desire to wanting that American presence there. How that presence evolves, or does it become a launch pad for, you know, special operations? We've done a lot of this, particularly in the Horn of Africa, remains to be seen. I think it's an important step forward. It shows the United States is committed to playing an increasing role. It's still a limited role, but this is something bigger. One other point, Laura.
Actually, Wayne, I'm going to have to cut you off.
Okay.
All right, and we're going to go to a short break. After the break, I'll let you pick up on that point. And I also want Colonel Cassidy and Bess's thoughts on increased drone activity by the U.S. in this region. So more after a short break. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Living Innovations, helping seniors live comfortably and safely in their own home with personalized care from a few hours per week to round the clock, livinginnovations.com. And New Hampshire Business Review presenting the 2013 Bob Awards featuring a psychedelic scene March 7th at the Grapponi Conference Center in Concord. Details at bobawardsnh.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
I've come to recognize what a letter from prison looks like. The address on the front of the envelope is usually written in pencil. That's one giveaway. And the return address has a very long code number. And this letter came from Folsom.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Don't miss the Moth, Saturday at 4 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan. And you can email us your questions in advance for the governor. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And then be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, Al-Qaeda's expansion into Africa, how this has happened, what might be at stake for the people there and for the U.S. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. What do you make of this expansion of terrorist organizations related to Al-Qaeda in Africa? Do you think they could be as much of a problem as those in Afghanistan were, even a bigger problem? What do you also think is the appropriate U.S. response to this changing situation in Africa? We're taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And just before the break, Wayne Lesperance at New England College, you were wrapping up a point. I did want to let you finish that up. Go ahead.
Just very
talking
quickly
about drones, yeah.
Right. And so just to segue a little bit, this idea that, you know, the population is going to stand up to these folks is really problematic. These groups are very well armed. There's a tremendous flow of arms coming through the region, particularly after Libya. So, you know, in northern Mali, the government tried. The government tried to, you know, basically wage war on this group and just could not do it, was not successful, which is what necessitated, you know, external forces coming in to support them. So we don't want to underestimate the strength of these groups in terms of the arms that they have and their training and their battle hardened. The other point I wanted to make.
Yeah, and Bess, to you first, and then you, Colonel Cassidy. Bess, as we said, you just got back from Niger working, doing humanitarian work there. Just about the time that it was announced that the U.S. was going to set up this drone base for surveillance drones, they say, although no one's ruling out the use of military strikes. They're just not saying so right now. What did people think about the establishment of this drone base in their country?
Well, from people that I've talked to, I think it's mostly frightening. You know,
even though the government signed this agreement and said, yes you can do it.
Yes. Nigerians, for the most part, really like Americans very much. And we've had a very positive relationships on the ground. You know, the Peace Corps there was very well loved. And I think that we're, you know, we have a sort of tender role to play now, and you know, it could go either way. I think if there's too much of an obvious military incursion, people worry that, you know, we don't know who the people are and the wrong people are affected. So that's one problem. But as Wayne said, the country also realizes that they need help, and they've been asking for help for years, you know, for exactly what he was talking about. Many, many arms have come across Libya, you know, through Niger to get to Mali. Niger is just in the crossroads of all these things. And so in terms of, you know, surveillance and keeping this trade from crossing Niger would be very helpful. On the negative side, people are worried because they see that it makes them not look like a neutral country and makes them a target of terrorists because the U.S. drones are coming out of Niger.
Wow. So on the one hand, people are feeling, yeah, we're feeling vulnerable. We would appreciate that American presence, a little more security. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they don't want that American presence to incite attack.
Yes.
Wow. You know, I want to pick up on something you said, Bess. We don't know who the people are. People are concerned that Americans don't really understand the region, understand the cultures, understand the people. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been so much publicity about the Tuareg, for example. And many of the Tuareg in Mali who are in these extremist groups had come back out of Libya. You know, Muammar Gaddafi has played a huge role with the Tuareg of West Africa for last couple of decades. He's incited rebellions. Many of the people who came back and, as I said, and started these problems in Mali came back out of Libya. They had been in Gaddafi's army. There were fewer of them, but also some Nigerian Tuareg. But this is by far a small minority of the population. Most Tuareg in Niger and Mali are poor, really poverty-stricken herders trying to make a living herding goats and sheep.
Across vast deserts.
Across vast deserts and searching for water and trying to live. It's really a tenuous existence. You know, Niger is the second poorest country in the world. And so being the Tuareg especially had this fear of being marked as a problem population.
Wow. Well, and I want to hit on that with you, Colonel Cassidy, because Bess has touched on something that I've read again and again and again, that the U.S. needs to be really cautious here because Africa's not really our specialty. We don't really understand the many cultures, languages, peoples, forces at work, Colonel Cassidy.
Well, I agree with that. It's a very complex continent. And I can tell you that the people that stood up the command were very diligent and studious in trying to figure out the continent in its entirety and its complexity, but we don't know enough. And that's frequently the case when we're operating in other parts of the world. I would say with the drones, it can be an effective short-term tool to address some of the symptoms, but it has to be used precisely. If it's not used with precision, then it can cause more harm than good. The long-term solution is to help these countries build indigenous security capacity to secure themselves. The other thing about drones is It's important to have a on the ground force of people that can actually provide the human intelligence to get the more accuracy and more precision when you're flying a drone. If you're just using a drone by itself, the risk of killing the wrong people increases.
Yeah, and that
which we don't want to do
creates resentment. And another question on that for you, Colonel Cassidy, and also perhaps you, Wayne. Colonel Cassidy, some people are now saying that the U.S. is relying too much on technology like these drones, not enough on intelligence, on talking to people. One former Bush administration official actually wrote against the use of drones by the Obama White House, saying rather than killing terrorist suspects, the U.S. should try to capture them and get information out of them. What do you think, Colonel Cassidy?
Well, my view is capturing is always the preferred solution because it does generate much more exploitable intelligence. However, in some places we're not willing or we're unable because of sovereign issues to put people on the ground or to get the people that are on the ground, like the Pakistani tribal areas, to do the work to get the precision to capture these folks. So you see drones being used quite a bit inside Pakistan in the tribal areas. I think it's a slippery slope. Now, my views here are my own and not the U.S. government, the U.S. Naval War College, but I think there's a point of diminishing returns. If you use drones in excess and you end up killing too many of the wrong people, then what you're doing is you're prolonging the war because you're generating more support for the adversary and their core leadership, and then you end up fighting a war in perpetuity because you keep on whacking the leadership. There's always somebody to fill them because the drone effects are causing more people to support the enemy.
Yeah, Wayne, to you, creating some of the antagonism that you mentioned earlier that some of the al-Qaeda groups have created among local populations.
Well, that's right. I think Colonel Cassidy has it exactly right. The counter-argument is that it's a heck of a lot cheaper to build and fly and use drones than it is to invest in, human intelligence. Beyond that, if a drone crashes, if a drone doesn't function properly, if a drone makes a mistake, it's a blip on the news media cycle. If U.S., special operations forces are killed or wounded or there's a problem with, Americans being deployed to capture a target, that makes big news, and it's politically very sensitive. And one of the, negative consequences of the decade of war that we've had since September 11th is that the American public is just no stomach for warfare. And, there's a tremendous fear in Washington of expanding our activities in a way that puts American soldiers at risk. So we rely on technology, and there are definitely some negative consequences associated with that.
Some positive consequences too, though, Wayne, it sounds like you're saying, this from this war fatigue. We're going to tread maybe a little more carefully than we used to.
Absolutely. The challenge is we have a very real problem in West Africa here. And so where we would benefit from having human intelligence sources, having folks to interpret the information and materials coming through the drones and other things, it becomes harder to do those things. So that's why the news story says only 100 soldiers are going to Niger to set up this facility. I mean, it's a very light footprint, and I expect that, it's a careful balancing act. My concern is that if we need more, will we have the support to deploy more in this part of the world to support the folks that are fighting these terrorist groups?
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's an email that came in from Deborah in Concord. She says, I'm concerned about radical Islamists getting a hold on West African countries such as Sierra Leone, where at least a generation of children have grown up in war. I have two adopted daughters from Sierra Leone and know how easily children were made to be child soldiers. I can't say enough about the importance of support for education and other positive aid. And then she says, thank you. And I'm going to just guess that she's thanking you, Bess, for doing the type of work that you do. What about that? The whole generation of children just growing up in this very warlike atmosphere. I wonder what you saw, heard, felt when you were in Niger about that.
In Niger, I would say we're not in that warlike atmosphere directly, but there's been rebellions, insecurity for a long time that children are growing up in. And, our organization, I'm the only American full-time. We have one part-time American who works with us in education, but we have all Nigerian staff. And our whole purpose is to help Nigerians help themselves through access to education. But our program is, supporting education by helping people form cooperative enterprises that they earn money, and they also use part of their money to support their schools, and they're happy to do it. And we're on the ground, and I think when we talk about being on the ground, it's we don't need just a military presence on the ground. We need people on the ground who know these communities, who are working there. That's how we'll know what's going on, and that's how we'll show them that there's ways forward. There's ways forward to earn money, to do what they're doing. They can stay where they are, but they can be more successful at it. And I hope people will take a look at our website, which is www.rain, R-A-I-N, the number 4, Sahara, as in the desert, Sahara.org. Rainforsahara.org.
When you were talking, too, it made me think maybe showing people there that the face of the U.S. is not just a face in uniform, that there are other humanitarian works going on and so forth.
Yes, you know, and I tell people all the time, because we're a small organization and most of our donors are people or foundations in the U.S., like Newman's Own and family foundations, not the government. And, you know, I tell people there are many people in the United States who have sent us this money to do this with you. And people are brought to tears by that, to think that people are thinking of them in the United States. And they're very, very welcoming people who want this assistance and are motivated to do their part.
A last question, I think, for you, Colonel Cassidy. What is the biggest mistake that you think the U.S. should look out for, try to avoid, given your experience in Afghanistan and across the Middle East, serving in the military? What's the number one mistake that you hope the U.S. avoids as it looks to counter the growing influence of al-Qaeda and similar groups in Africa?
Well, I think the greatest mistake that we made collectively since 9/11 was massive overreach to the point where we almost exhausted ourselves beyond a point of no return. I mean, most figures would say that the operation on 9/11 roughly cost about $500,000. Figures vary on what we spent in reaction or overreacting to it, from over $500 billion to trillions of dollars, if you look at the costs of Iraq and Afghanistan put together. So I would say that the main mantra or a caveat would be, you know, less is better, and work through and with host nation partners to make them better, help them help themselves, and the lean and discreet presence through special operations and conventional operators to advise and assist is probably the way we're going to go in Africa.
Can you give us just a little more on, because you've mentioned this point a couple times, Colonel Cassidy, a little bit more on what that means, help them help themselves. You touched on it, but I'd love a little more detail.
What I mean is having an advisory group or the country team have a sufficient military piece where they can work with the indigenous army, where we have police advisors to work with the indigenous police, host nation police. And I'm not talking about a huge presence, because a huge presence can cause more harm than good, but enough expertise, enough capacity to work with these countries' forces to make them more capable, more effective, and also to make them more professional in that they do not prey on the people, they're less corrupt, and they do exhibit a degree of moral rectitude. You don't want to have police out there that are preying on the population, because if your police are a catalyst for people joining the armed groups, then you've got a massive problem.
Yeah, and Wayne, to you, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, now, you know, sort of putting his boots on the feet on the ground and implementing his own approach toward foreign relations. Just this morning, there was word that Secretary Kerry had decided that the U.S. might need to get more involved in Syria. What does that say to you, Wayne, about Secretary Kerry's approach toward getting involved in troubled parts of the world, trying to tamp down al-Qaeda in Africa, for example?
Well, I think that he's not afraid of, and he talked quite a bit about this when he was in the Senate, not afraid to use, you know, American power, soft power and hard power throughout the world. And I think that in Africa, the mistake would be to think of this as a military mission. This is as much a humanitarian mission, a civilian mission, as it is a military mission, in my view. And so for the Secretary of State to emphasize those sorts of things, I think is very important. Look, I mean, there are NGOs and PVOs, people doing the work that Beth is doing, that they know what's going on the ground. The United States can play a role in supporting those agencies, those groups, in effecting positive change that has a long-term impact. And I keep wanting to emphasize that the military role is a short-term solution. It will not solve the long-term problem, in my view. So I think it's a positive step for Secretary Kerry. And I think we can, let's see how this develops. It's still very early in his tenure, and, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and what do you think? I'd love to ask you that question too, Bess. What mistake do you hope the U.S. avoids as its presence in Africa increases to try and tamp down threats from terrorist groups?
You know, I personally look at, you know, Pakistan and see the issues that have come up there in trying to both have an ally and fighting the region, you know, the countries around it. And I liken Niger to that sometimes. I think that the United States is trying to have a lighter hand from what I've seen. And I think that that's a positive thing. And that I have seen, you know, with the new government in Niger the last couple of years, the United States has been there training their military, training their police, and we can see the difference in the way people are treated and the effectiveness. And I think
a positive difference,
a very positive change for the good in Niger. Well, and I think there's hope there.
It's a serious topic, so I appreciate you ending it on a hopeful note. Bess, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That's Bess Palmisano, founder of the organization RAIN, which works to improve access to education, jobs, and other resources for the peoples of West Africa. Wayne Lesperance, thank you also for being with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura. Thanks.
Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement, and Colonel Robert Cassidy, thank you also for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Robert Cassidy, military professor at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.